Accession number 10165, reel number 36.
Martin McLean, reel 36. You were telling me how your friend left at the Poona railway station to go for Indian Army officer.
The last I saw Pat, he was leaning out the train waving as he went off. And I went back to the battalion. Just got stuck in the train as normal. Pat came back to the battalion about a fortnight later on, a most dejected man. He'd been turned down for his likely material for being an officer. And him and I, over a can of beer or a bottle of beer or whatever it was we had a drink, and I was trying to console him about it. And he was telling me, he says, Martin, you'd never believe it. And he was a great, good footballer, a good sportsman, always. He says, they asked me if I played rugby. And he says, no, I didn't play rugby. He says, I played football. He says, what schools did you went to? He says, I went to elementary school. He says, and they are the only grounds which I was turned down on. He says, which I can think of. Now, I'm going to say this, and I'll say it to anyone. This man was an excellent soldier. He was a model British soldier in Sergeant Major ways, in every way you could think of. I used to look up to him when I first met him as Lance Corporal, and then I became Sergeant Major, and we became pals together. As Lance Corporals were pals, and way up the line. But this man was a great soldier. And it's rather funny that Pat settled down begrudgingly back to army life. And about a month later on, the command officer sent for him and showed him an Indian Army Council instruction, or a War Office Council instruction, that no officer, no man who applied for a commission in the army, no matter where it was, would be turned down by the aptitude board or the selection board. The man would be marked according to what they thought and then sent off to OCTU and let OCTU decide whether this man would become an efficient soldier. So Pat was given another chance. He was reluctant to take it, but we talked him over to go because his heart was set on it. And we knew he was finished as a sergeant major because he'd lost the interest, you know, being turned down as an officer. And him and I had many discussions on this because he was a reservist now. He'd been out the army and come back in, and he didn't wish to stay in the army. He had nothing to lose by becoming an officer. And so Pat reapplied and went off to Belgaume, OCTU. And do you know this man that they turned down? He got the Sword of Honour for the best soldier, the best officer that the school had produced. I'll tell you a little more about Pat later on, but that's it. The battalion looked as if it was getting onto a more warlike footing. And then they moved us once again from Ahmednagar to a place called Juhu. It was near Bombay, but well away from Bombay, away from the flesh pots. The men couldn't walk there, that's for sure. And I always went on the advance parties. Don't ask me how. Even when we went from England to France, I was on the advance party. Maybe it was because I could drive motorbikes and anything that was going. It was always handy to have a sergeant who could fall in where somebody went sick or something. Or maybe I was good at planning and layout of land. But I was on this advance party to Juhu, and we landed in this place, and it was like a wide, dried riverbed. And I looked at this, and it was a river leading out to the sea. And there was a causeway across it, which we crossed, and we pointed out where we had to camp. And it was a virgin place. Nothing had been there before. And we went there and looked at the place. It was a beautiful place. You had to see it. It's just like one of the things you see out of a brochure of a holiday resort. We stood near the mouth of the river went out. There was a promontory, like the pond, the land jutting out. We went in further towards the beach. As far as you could see, beautiful white sands, rolling deep sands, coconut trees, and somewhere along, somebody had put these little thatched huts. Just two or three of them. They were private ones, maybe belonged to the white people coming on holiday, we don't know. But it was a magnificent piece of land for it to take the battalion on train. Now, the object of this was they had one or two amphibious, real amphibious landing crafts. And they wanted to train everyone in the use of them, getting in, getting out. And also another thing, when we were there, everybody had to be taught as much as possible to swim. So for this, they provided the rubber dinghies and life belts, to blow up ones. And the idea was to form the men up and get them on, well, not form them, form them in classes. Non-swimmers, poor swimmers, and good swimmers. Well, getting in this camp, it was an experience for me. As I say, I was on an advanced party. Again, with the train we're now getting, we had to be undercover. The tents had to be undercover from aircraft, observation, and things like this. Well, the only possible place I could see for battalion headquarters was in a banana grove. And there was loads of young banana trees growing. I don't know whose ground it was, not that we worried them days. And we tried to pull these things out and couldn't, so we hooked a truck with its tow rope on, and we found they came out very easy. They were very shallow roots. And we took hundreds of these out because the palm trees growing in between them gave us the camouflage, or the hidden effect, for the marquees for Battalion HQ. And so we found out that we could pull these trees out very easy, and we'd done this and got the battalion headquarters tents up, and then got all our company tents up in similar places. But we ruined lots and lots of apple trees, banana trees. I didn't know what sort of trees they were until later on when I saw one growing bananas. Then everybody got buckled down to swimming, training. We had to wait our turns to go on this amphibious craft. So the whole of the unit was spent on sports on the sand, roundabouts on, rounders. That's about the only thing you could play, bits of football, because the sand was so soft that you sank into it. And swimming. A great lot of time was spent on swimming. For instance, the likes of the good swimmers, I must say I was a strong swimmer myself, were formed into a lifeguard group of men. We always had to be on attendance when the lads were out learning to swim. And with us we had this little rubber dinghy, which was a hold two men with comfort, small thing, which was to help to get them out. And we were on duty teaching the men to swim, but at the same time keeping an eye on for non-swimmers. Well, although this place was a beautiful place, there was a very strong tide, because the tidal waters of the river near at hand must have contained some very flat land. And as the sea went in, it flooded out in the flatland, because when it came out this river on low tide, it came out with such a rush, the tide was very, very dangerous. So during the tides, we tried as much as possible to avoid this period for swimming. So we concentrate on sport. The battalion was doing well. We're getting some lads to swim. Everybody's getting sunburnt. Well, more sunburnt. We're all sunburnt now. We look like a lot of niggers.
Had you mentioned you'd given up the, you changed from the steel helmet to the pith helmet. Had that happened from the pith helmet to the steel helmet? That happened at Armanaga, or was
I must correct myself there. No, we're still in the same system. When we're on peacetime activities like quarter guards, we wore the pith helmet. When we were on warlike activities, it was still the steel helmet. So all training and everything was done with steel helmets.
How about the actual landing craft drill? What was that? What did that entail?
Well, it meant that we had, you've led me off track there, to assist us in, or facilitate us in our idea of landing craft drill. There was only two or three landing craft that were run by the Navy lads, and so they'd done exactly the same as they'd done when we were in Bridlington. We used to go out of a daytime and we'd made up a mock-up of a landing craft with its ramps down, and would put sandbags along for the side seats, sandbags along for the middle seats, and it was like a bit of an enclosure indicating a landing craft. And we would file in there every night time, take up our positions, and then on the landing craft ramps supposedly come down, charge out of that. Well, they made such much the same at this place, so the people could practice entering and getting out of a landing craft quickly without the actual craft being there. And so we took our turns in this. There was one day that we were on Juhu beaches, and I had my company away in the distance on sport. And at this time, it's obvious, and I say it was a good thing, because the sergeant had the company on his own. The officers then were free. They weren't on parades or anything of that nature. And they in turn used to do their little bits of stuff, their games. Well, anyway, I was away in the distance. I heard some calls for help. Help! And I was getting panicky. And so I took the good swimmers along, and there was quite a lot of people on the sand. And they said, your old company commander's in the water, he's lost. So in we went looking for him, we couldn't find him. And there was one boat in the area, one rowing boat, and the second in command of the battalion, Major Gibbs Kennett, the training officer of the battalion, Major Gibbs Kennett, got the boat out. And him and I went out, and I was going into the water looking for him, but we never saw any sign of him. The tide had caught him, and he was away. He was rolled up the next morning. Now, the sad thing of all this is he was such a well-liked man. But this happens with everyone. Everyone is well-liked by somebody or hated by others.
And what was it? Was this Todd? Or that?
There's two lists of Todds in the battalion. That's what I'm coming on to. We have two lists of Todds in the battalion. We had this senior one who'd been with us in France, and his brother had joined us. And this brother I told you about in the first instance was the reinforcement company commander. And he was the one who was lost. And Lister Toddy's brother was still in the battalion as second in command. And he was awfully upset. Well, obviously. He spent the night searching the beaches for his brother, and he found him. And so did the officers patrolling the beaches. And he was washed up the next morning dead. As a matter of fact, when they auctioned his kit, you know, auction, when a man dies in a battalion through unwarlike activities, they always have an auction, as in the old days, of the man's kit, his sleeping bags, his everything, even his socks, so as to raise money up for the next of kin, you know. Maybe the Lister Todd's, Captain Lister Todd's family didn't want it, but it was decided to hold an auction sale. And I went along and had a few quid because we had no means of spending anything. And the auction went on. I got his kid bag, not his kid bag, his sleeping bag. Well, officers had a bedroll with huge leather straps on them, which was part of the Sandhurst equipment, by the way. And they used to wrap all the bedding up and tie them up with these leather straps. I got that. And I got his tin trunk. Well, the object of the tin trunk, I bought them mainly because I wanted to contribute to a great bloke.
Would people pay over the odds?
Very much over the odds. Very much. As a matter of fact, we used to bid for them. They might get the value of the box. Say the box is £5, and somebody bid £5, or it'd start low, go up £5, £10, £15. I think I got it for about £10, and I got his bedroom for £5.
That's a lot of money in those days.
It was a lot of money, but you see, it was towards a person that we thought something of. We couldn't buy wreaths. We couldn't send flowers, and that was it. And so the captain's kit was auctioned and bought like that. So that is only just to give you an idea of army procedure. For instance, a private soldier dies in some tragic circumstances, or any circumstances, there'd be an auction of his kit in the company stores, and the lads would go along and they'd buy a pair of socks. Now, they could get brand new socks from the quartermaster stores for maybe nineties or something of that nature. I'm only quoting the price. I can't remember what they were now. Thick woolen grey socks and shirts and kiddie and swagger cane. The things that they could sell and use again. And the men would go and bid for them. His friends would go and bid for them so as to raise up the amount of money. They might pay three shillings for them socks, which they could buy three sets of brand new ones or four sets of brand new ones from the quartermaster. And the a bid like that, just to what they could afford to give a contribution without having their name put on the list to the man's deceased people for to help their name, for to help them.
That would have happened after the chap fell in the well, would it?
Yes, that did as well, yes. Any tragedy in the army, they had this system of auctioning the man's kit and selling it off in that manner. Anyway, the captain, we had to get on with training, obviously. It came our turn to go off on the amphibious craft. And through this practice of getting on and off things, on and off this mock-ups that we had, we just walked onto the boat, the LCI, Landingcraft Infantry, just the one that holds the platoon, walked onto the plane in the reverse order that we march off. In other words, the officers would be in the front, they'd be the last on the boat. The section commanders would be the last ones on the boat because they ought to be the first off. So the sections marched off. Imagine a platoon marching, platoon commander, the section commanders, and the others following. That is of the 1-3s. And then they marched back in the reverse order. They're about to march onto the boat, so they came off in the order of battle.
Would that not mean if you had the platoon commander and the section commanders right in the front, that if you were landing under fire, you could lose the whole of
you could, yes. But that was the system, and that was how it was done. Because then you had your second in command of the section who'd take over, or somebody. It was just a game of chance. You had to go off. And so the practices, getting on the boat, bring us into land, and disperse and attack. We didn't get much opportunity to this, but I think we went on the landing craft twice. It was good practice. We didn't need much more of it. But it was a novelty going on the landing craft. It was a novelty being driven out to sea in a motorised vessel and attacking, rather as sitting on a piece of land with just on sandbags representing a boat. At this time, I got issued with this Thompson submachine gun. We got a huge quarter, I think it was about 40 Thompson submachine guns, these gangster-like weapons that they used to see in the films, where they used to fire automatic, the gangsters using, ripping off their enemies and things of this nature, and the FBI shooting up the baddens. And they had the round drums and the single round drum of ammunition. And they also had the slip-on cart cases for just so many rounds, a magazine. They gave us these things without a book of instruction. They just got the gun, still in this mineral jelly red. Mineral jelly red is protective grease, to protect it, no matter where it is, from rust and any deterioration. We took the mineral jelly red off, but we didn't know it stripped the guns, because there was a very strong spring in it, and we didn't know how to get it out, because one man took his gun to bits and all the working parts flew out. Well, if they go in the sand and things like that and you lose parts, the gun's no good. So we eventually caught on. Somebody got a nail and stuck it through a little hole, which obviously that was meant for. They pulled the working parts back and they stuck this nail through the hole. And when they reassembled the gun, the spring wasn't effective. They could take the gun to bits. And so we learned in a simple methods how to strip and clean the guns. Well, we treat these guns lovingly, because we wanted something of this nature. With all our jungle training, we realised we were short, at least I realised, that we were short of automatic weapons. The rifles, I know, a great thing, the rifle. It was the best infantry weapon of the lot. They can have them all. That's just my poor experiences of infantry weapons. The Bren gun was a good one, but I wasn't so much involved with it. They were good with the lads, but let's put it this way. You're in the jungle, and you see the enemy. You bring your rifle up to aim at them. You can't see the foresight for green. So you've got to fire by chance. You know, you've got to fire by instinct, more or less. Well, we wanted a short, stubbed... We thought the American Garand rifle that we'd seen in films was the ideal thing. An automatic rifle with a short barrel was the ideal thing for what we wanted. Well, when we got these Thompson submachine guns, these are what we wanted. We'd done a lot of jungle training, and so we thought this was the ideal thing for us. The company commander, I was an awful bloke for singing Irish songs them days. A beautiful day, and I was sitting outside the marquee with the company commander in there with these officers. They must have been having a bit of a conference, and I was sitting outside just whistling and singing to myself Irish songs. I came from Irish ancestry, but I disowned them entirely for what they'd done to the British, giving secrets away about ship movements after war. I ceased to be an Irishman. I was an Englishman from there on. Anyway, I was sitting singing these songs, and company commander comes stalking out, Major Hutton. "Come on, Sergeant Major, bring that gun, let's go and have a fire at it." I said, "Sir, we're not allowed to fire it. We haven't got the ammunition." He says, come on. So we had 5 rounds each for the weapon, which we're told we could use as practice, only 5, because we hadn't received much ammunition. So off we went along the beaches, and the lads were out swimming and what have you. I found a spot where if you shot out to sea, you wouldn't interfere with anybody, because we're more liberal with weapons them days. You know, we want red flags and all this sort of thing. You could go and have a shoot. So found a spot, and I showed them how to load and fire single rounds. I said, first of all, try with a single round so that you get the feel of the weapon. And he fires around, and I'm looking out to see for the strike of the bullet, to see if it had, you know, as you actually do when you teach a man to load a gun in the army, it doesn't matter where it is. You show the man what to do, you know he's ready to fire, you look out at the target or look to your front for the strike of the bullet. I couldn't see any strike of bullet, but I didn't like the sound of the explosion of the gun. So I said, hold it, sir, don't fire anymore. I don't like the sound of that gun. I said, there's something wrong with that. I said, I've never seen the strike of the bullet. And I said, I didn't like the sound of that explosion. He says, nonsense, Sarmage. He says, you're overcautious. You don't take a chance. And he up with a gun and fires again. I'm looking out to see, and I hear a bigger explosion. And I turn around quickly, and there's the company commander crumpling to the ground, unconscious or out. And straight away, the gun had dropped into the sand. And I get a hold of him before he hits the bottom. And I'm straight away looking for wounds, for where he'd been hit, what had happened to him. And this sort of the other. Now, the sound of the bang, explosion, had brought other people running, and the officers came around. What's happened? I said, I don't know. The major was firing a gun. Down he went. And then he started recovering. And he had a black mark on his face. And the officers led him off to the first aid dressing station. He was staggering, but they had their arms around him, you know, like a wounded man, and they led him off. And I felt very guilty about this, because through handling the gun and letting him fire it, I had sort of thought I was a bit responsible. I was a bit of a bogey for weapons. And I picked the Bren gun up, the Thompson submachine gun up, and lo and behold, we looked at it in amazement. The whole side of the gun, where the cotton handle was blown out, and a metal part had peeled right back. And how it didn't hit the major in the face and in the eyes, we'll never know. But he must have felt it and pulled it away from him a bit, or flinched. The gun had a breech block explosion and was destroyed. It was taken to the armourers. We had a Royal Army Ordnance Corps sergeant attached to the battalion. In all battalions they had them. They vanished shortly after this. We never saw them again. Who was responsible for the inspection and checking of weapons of a battalion, or anything went wrong with them, and the sighting of weapons and things of that nature. And he went away, and he come back to me later on. He says, Martin, have a look. I saw Major. He was ROC, could call us Martin, but if it was about one of my sergeants, I'd be sir. And he showed me the bullets. Both bullets had jammed inside of each other. The first one hadn't left the barrel. The second one had banged against it and caused the breech block explosion. The first one, through, hadn't got out. There'd been an explosion inside the breech as well, which we didn't know about, and we just accepted as part of the gun's firing. The second one went. Now, there's never a court inquiry carried on about that. Now, if that had been peacetime, there'd have been a 100% court inquiry, the failure of the weapon, the cause of it, what had happened, because the major had been hurt. He hadn't been hurt, really. He was back on duty within a few hours. And there'd be a full inquiry. This thing seemed to just be hushed up, brushed aside as one of the incidents of war. Now, this had sad repercussions on the battalion later on, which I won't tell you now. I'll tell you about it when we went down to the Arakan fighting.
Did you get to fire any of the other Thompsons when more ammunition arrived?
No. They gave me another Thompson submachine gun, and that was that. We didn't fire them. It's funny, this. You go into action and you don't fire guns. We had enough for our bandoliers and our bandoliers. We'd done away with the drum. It was too bulky. They gave us equipment with slits in so we could put the magazines in. We had about 8 magazines for gun loaded with about 40 rounds.
Who would have the Thompsons? Everyone or...?
No. Section commanders of the platoon, company sergeant majors, and I think the runners had a one as well. The company runner to Battalion HQ had a one. I don't know the full disposition of them, but I know the section commanders in my company had a one, I had a one. And that was the full limit of the issue. I didn't want a one. I was a boy for the rifle. But that was Sergeant Major, take one, that was it.
There's no sign of the Sten at this stage?
None at all. So,
how long were you at Juhu?
We were at Juhu for about a month, I'd say. The battalion had done well in swimming. We'd learnt a lot of men to swim. We'd nearly had one tragedy, by the way. A mass tragedy. And it was only by Major Lister Todd, come back that name again, who was now second in command of the battalion. I think he was second in command. In fact, I'm sure he was. We're down on the beach one day, and one of these tides turned quickly, and some of the non-swimmers with the life belts were being swept out to sea, and some of the lads who'd progressed onto swimming who had no life belts on were being swept out. And we swimmers went out and started hauling them out and pulling them into where they could get their feet in the bottom. Without being brave or anything like that, I was just part of a job, part of a soldier's job. Some men were getting well out, and so Major Lister Todd got all the tall men, and he sent them out first, holding hands, and they formed a chain of men so that we could bring a man in and hand him over to the chain of men. And they'd crawl, terrified, along back to the sand. I think we'd lost about 10 men if it hadn't been, that this chain hadn't been formed by Major Lister Todd. It was a very quick thing, but we got our men out and we lost none. And it was a very lucky thing indeed, because the tide was very strong. When we went out, we could feel it. But it was more undertow, it was more catching the legs at the bottom. So
Lister Todd Jr. was the, or the brother, was the only one that was killed then?
It was the junior that was killed. It was the senior that was left.
And he was the only casualty during the swimming?
Yes, the only one. Time came for us to go back to Armenaga. Back we went. And the battalion was now getting into a state where they were really an amphibious battalion, ready for war. Now, part of a scheme which we never knew about was they were going to attack. Now, I'm on the wrong trend there. No. We're now ready for war, amphibious-wise. We went back to Armenaga. And then one day, the battalion company commanders are sent for. An independent brigade has to be formed from the 2nd Division, and that 6th Infantry Brigade had been selected as part of that independent brigade, and it would be known as that 6th Infantry Brigade Independent Brigade. Three battalions, and they got the Royal Scots to join us. And we were being rushed up to India with an intent to do a landing, a seaborne landing, on a place, on an island. That's all we knew at that stage. And we quickly collected all our gear, left our peacetime kit didn't amount to anything. We bought ourselves a walking out dress, you know, and different things we'd collected. But when we moved off to war, you left all that. And I left men my tin trunk that I'd bought, Lister Todd's tin trunk. Good thing, because the white ants were very prevalent them days, and you used to eat all your stuff. If the white ants got among your stuff, you just found shreds of uniform and kits. And off we went with marching, FSMO as we call it, Field Service Marching Order, a sea kit bag, and our weapons of war, fully laden. We got on a train at Armenaga, and was 6 days in a train. It's unbelievable, you know. We lads, we in England, we'd been on a train, and we'd gone to a station, maybe a day, maybe a few hours on it. We thought we'd been on a long journey. This, we went on 6 days on a train, right up to the peak end of India, up through Calcutta. And it was amazing to sleep in a troop train.
What was the troop train like?
They were very primitive, wooden lats for seats. But they were some of them were made up in the bunks where you could sleep above, you know, where you put your rack luggage. There would be bunks. And on the bottom would be wooden lattice seats. And some of them would fold over to make a bed as well. There were six warrant officers to a carriage, to a compartment. And all the men were well looked after in this case. They had somewhere to sleep. And were distributed on this train, a great long train. And off were shot, steaming through India. And this is where your eyes get opened about India. I told you before that we had little contact with Indians. We'd moved off to, in body, to a camp. We'd stayed in body as a camp. When we went on holiday, we went in the holiday places, more or less, Pune. We did see a bit of India, but this is where you see the real rough part of India when you're travelling in the train. The train used to stop every now and again for water or for such things as